Hi, and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Steve Sacco. Today I'll be reading from Time Magazine. And since the April 22nd, 2024 edition of Time has not arrived as of yet, I found some articles online that we could do this week. Let's start with How Israel May Respond to the Iran Attack. This is by Anna Gordon from April 2024, time.com. Israel's leaders met during a war cabinet meeting to discuss the country's response after Iran launched a combination of 170 drones, 30 cruise missiles, and 120 ballistic missiles towards Israel's soil in the early hours of the morning. It was the first time the Islamic Republic, long hostile to the Israeli state, directly attacked Israel after decades of proxy conflict. Iran says that its attack was launched in response to an Israeli strike on April 1st on an Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, which killed a senior individual in Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards, along with 8 other officers. So far, Iran's attack seems to have caused minimal damage. No deaths have been reported, though one 7-year-old appears to be in life-threatening condition after shrapnel from an intercepted Iranian missile fell directly on her home. Israel had support from American, British, and French partners who helped to thwart the 99% of the Iranian aerial threats, and that's according to an IDF spokesperson, Daniel Hagari. Jordan also intercepted some of the Iranian projectiles that flew over its territory despite fiercely criticizing Israel's war in Gaza, which has killed at least 33,000 people, including 13,000 children. International pressure. The U.S. has urged Israel not to retaliate to avoid escalating the situation into a broader regional war. Slow things down and think through how to respond, President Biden was quoted saying to Prime Minister Netanyahu, according to a report from the Washington Post. He also told Netanyahu that Israel should be satisfied with its successful response and to leave it at that. You gotta win, take the win, Biden said, according to Axios. Leaders in France and Britain have called on Israel to restrain itself, fearing that the destabilizing consequences of a broader war would occur. H. A. Hellyer, a senior fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, says that Israel's response will be heavily based on whether or not the United States will penalize them for acting too strongly. It depends on do they think that the United States has their back and will not penalize them, says Hellyer. The reality is that the United States has tremendous leverage over Israel and has so far refused to use it. Israel receives approximately 68% of its foreign-sourced weapons from the United States, in addition to at least $3 billion in military aid per year. The United States appeared to pause Israel's actions in Gaza for the first time last month when President Biden refused to green light an Israeli military operation in Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city, without guarantees that the Palestinian civilians would be protected. Israel's internal politics. Nevertheless, Netanyahu faces strong pressures from Israel's right-wing parties to retaliate against Iran. They argue that if Israel does not respond harshly, there will be nothing to deter the Islamic Republic from striking again and severely disrupting the lives of the Israelis. We must respond so that the rockets from Iran won't become routine like the rockets from Gaza, said an Israeli parliament member who is part of Netanyahu's Likud party, and he said that on Israeli television. Intercepting Iranian missiles and drones is extremely financially costly, and Israelis are eager to avoid Iran sending a similar barrage again. For now, it appears that Israeli officials are leaning towards some kind of non-immediate response. Yesterday, Israeli Minister Benny Gantz said that Israel would respond in some way but did not specify how. This episode is not over. We will build a regional coalition against the threat of Iran and we will exact a price from them at a time that suits us, he said. Gantz is one of 3 members of Israel's war cabinet, along with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israeli Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant. The cabinet was established after the war in Gaza began and meets at least once every 48 hours. During the most recent meeting, it appeared as though the war cabinet had come to a conclusion that they would not respond to Iran, but still has not come to an agreement as to how significant of an attack they would launch. Regional dynamics. From a regional point of view, the attack was a reminder that despite the war in Gaza, Israel still has allies in the Arab world, according to Yossi Mecklenburg, an associate fellow at the Chatham House who specializes in Middle East politics. Iran probably also got the message that if it tries to attack Israel, there will be a response not only from Israel, but from its allies, including within the Arab world. Iran has long been engaged in some sort of proxy conflict with Saudi Arabia, as the two powers compete for dominance in the region. While Israel is disliked by much of the Arab world, multiple Arab countries showed that they are willing to work with Israel over Iran in order to curb the Islamic Republic's influence. The Wall Street Journal reported in addition to Jordan striking down some of the missiles, multiple Gulf countries shared intelligence with the United States and Israel regarding Iran's drone and missile launches. Should Israel retaliate, Iran has vowed to respond with an even stronger response. I emphasize that any new adventure against the interests of the Iranian nation will be met with a heavier and regrettable response, said Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, on X, also known as Twitter. Next we have, from Time.com, how Kate Cox became a reluctant face of the abortion rights movement, and is by Charlotte Alter. In the tidy backyard of Kate Cox's Dallas area bungalow, there are two child-sized lawn chairs, alongside two toddler bicycles parked beneath a brick wall scrawled with chalk. There are two red and white stuffed horses in the playroom, and two sippy cups sitting in the sink. This is the joyful, messy life that Kate and Justin Cox always wanted. Everywhere you look, there are two of everything. The problem is, there should have been three. Last year, the Coxes were thrilled to learn that Kate was pregnant again. They'd always planned to have a large family, three, maybe even four kids. When Cox saw the positive pregnancy test in August, she ran to the playroom to tell Justin, who was wrestling on the floor with their three-year-old and their 18-month-old. Justin immediately started planning. Would they need a bigger car? Would they mean to have their finances looked at? Kate didn't share in any of these worries. She was just excited. At first, the pregnancy progressed normally. The Cox family designed a little cartoon to announce the happy news to their tight-knit extended family. Kate went on to her early prenatal appointments and scans, eager to find out whether the baby was a boy or a girl. When Cox was around 18 weeks pregnant, she got a call from the doctor while she was still in the car. She asked me if I was driving, Kate recalls. So I pulled the car over in an empty parking lot. The doctor told me that the results of her early screening tests indicated a risk of trisomy 18, a life-threatening genetic condition. I cried for a while in the car, says Cox. In that same phone call, she told us that we were having a girl. It took weeks of additional testing, appointments with maternal-fetal medicine specialists, terrifying ultrasounds, and excruciating waiting before doctors confirmed the diagnosis. Each time we had an ultrasound, there was more bad news, Cox recalls, speaking slowly during an interview in her living room in early March. The neural tube, the heart, the brain, the skull, the limbs. It was hard, because when you looked, it was very visible, and you could see on the ultrasound that she wasn't like other babies. By the end, sometimes I couldn't even look at the screen, she says. Trisomy 18 is almost a fatal condition. In rare cases, babies with milder forms of the disease can survive for years, even into adolescence. But Cox's doctor told her that there were so many malformations to the daughter's brain, spine, and neural tube that the baby would probably die in utero. If not, she would be placed directly into hospice care after being born, where doctors did not expect her to survive more than a few days. Every single case of trisomy 18 I've seen has demised, if not in utero, then within the early days after birth, says Dr. Damla Carson, Cox's OBGYN. Even if they do survive, the standard of care is comfort care. Do not resuscitate. The diagnosis also put Cox's own health and future fertility at risk. Her pregnancy was becoming increasingly complicated. She went to the emergency room several times for cramping, elevated vitals, and fluid in her birth canal. If the baby died in utero, Cox could get a significant infection, and because she had delivered her first two children via C-section, a third delivery carried increased risk of utero rupture. If she was induced or had another C-section, her doctor told her she might never be able to have children again. The more C-sections you have, the more risk of hysterectomy, hemorrhage, uterine rupture, says Dr. Carson. She was at heightened risk. Given a failed diagnosis and her own medical history, Kate and Justin decided to terminate the pregnancy. It was really painful, of course, because we wanted our baby so badly, says Cox. But we didn't want her to suffer, and the risks to me were too high. I also have two other babies, and they need their mommy, so I had to make a decision with all of my babies in mind. But abortion is illegal in Texas in all but the most urgent medical situations. Doctors who perform them face immense legal risks. And Cox's physician told her that because the fetus still had a heartbeat, Cox probably did not qualify for a medical exception. I couldn't believe that I wasn't qualified, given the risk I had faced in my pregnancy. My baby was not going to live, she says, pausing to wipe away the tears. So I was really shocked that I couldn't get medical care here in Texas. I wanted to be in my home. I wanted to have my doctors that I trust close by. I wanted to be able to come home and hug my babies, be close to my mom, and be able to cry on my own pillow. But that was not possible. And so, instead of becoming a mother of three, Kate Cox has become an unlikely national figure. The first pregnant woman in the midst of a health crisis to sue for the right to an abortion since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. Now, months after she was forced to leave her home state to terminate her non-viable pregnancy, Cox is speaking out in detail for the first time about her experience. She's becoming a reluctant advocate for reproductive rights, the most prominent example of how abortion bans can endanger even women who desperately wanted to be mothers. Before this ordeal, Kate and Justin Cox had never thought much about abortion. I wanted a big family, says Kate, sitting at her kitchen table, underneath a big print of a Madonna and child. The living room is scattered with unicorn books. There's a stuffed Olaf, the snowman from Frozen. I just didn't think it was going to be something that would ever be in my life. The Coxes weren't especially political in general. Neither Kate nor Justin are reliable voters, they say, and they don't necessarily identify with either political party. Between raising two toddlers and working full-time jobs, Justin works in IT and Kate works at a nonprofit, they were just trying to stay afloat, as Kate puts it. They didn't pay much attention to the news. When the Supreme Court issued the Dobbs decision, it floated across their radars but didn't seem to matter very much to their lives. When Texas's strict abortion ban went into effect shortly after that, neither paid much attention, because they both assumed that they would be medical exceptions. When Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton warned that doctors who provided these abortions could be held criminally liable, the news barely registered. Once Cox's doctors told her that she couldn't get an abortion in Texas, Cox started Googling to learn more about the state law. That's how she came across the Center for Reproductive Rights, the CRR, a legal advocacy organization that had filed a lawsuit. Zurowski versus Texas, on behalf of two OBGYNs and 20 women in Texas who were denied abortion care, asking the court to clarify the scope of the state's medical emergency exception to its abortion ban. Cox sent a cold email to CRR and was connected to Molly Duane, a senior staff attorney who was the lead attorney on the Zurowski case. Cox explained that her fetus had a fatal diagnosis and that her doctor had told her that because of her medical history, continuing the pregnancy carried risks for both her own health and future fertility. Duane agreed to help her try to obtain an abortion in Texas. CRR is representing dozens of patients challenging abortion restrictions in multiple states. But Cox's case was different because she was currently pregnant and in medical crisis, according to Nancy Northrup, president of the Center for Reproductive Rights. Kate was the first time since Roe was overturned that a woman who was currently pregnant, needing an abortion under the health exception, went to court to get a court order for an abortion, Northrup says. Her situation, according to Northrop, exposes how some medical exceptions to abortion bans are written in a way that makes them nearly impossible to apply. What Kate Cox's case shows is that the argument of the states that they have exceptions to their blanket abortion bans for the health of the woman is false. They don't have exceptions, and they won't allow exceptions to be applied. On December 7th, a Texas judge granted Cox a temporary restraining order, allowing her to terminate her pregnancy and shielding the doctors from prosecution under the Texas law. But almost immediately, Attorney General Paxton petitioned the Texas Supreme Court to halt the lower court's order and threatened local hospitals with legal action if they allowed the abortion to proceed. At that point, Kate was roughly 20 weeks pregnant. After a few days of waiting for a ruling from the Texas Supreme Court, she and Justin decided that they couldn't wait any longer. They left their two young children with relatives and went to New Mexico to terminate the pregnancy. On December 12th, she was finally able to get an abortion, but only after uprooting her life to travel out of state. That experience added a lot of pain and suffering to what was already the hardest and most difficult time in their lives, she says. Before the termination, they had named the baby Chloe Jones. It was kind of a name that was in our hearts for the next baby girl, says Cox with a small smile. And she'll always be our baby. That middle name was after Kate's grandfather, she adds, so that way she would know who to look for in heaven. Months later, Cox finally feels that she can talk about the ordeal in detail. She recalls how the weeks between the trisomy 18 diagnosis and finally terminating her pregnancy were excruciating. She would take her children to the grocery store, and people would smile at her and ask when she was due. Acquaintances would ask if she was having a baby shower. Her three-year-old daughter was so excited that she was having another sibling. She didn't understand that there would not be a new baby coming home. Although Kate did not want the abortion, she says she's grateful she was able to get one. The alternative would have been worse, she says. I didn't want to have to wait until my baby died in my belly or died during birth, or have told her in my arms that she suffocates or has a heart attack. The experience has opened Kate and Justin's eyes to the ways their family could be affected by laws that seem to have little to do with them. As a nation, we have a lot to learn about abortion, says Cox. Sometimes prayed for, wanted pregnancies end in abortion. It's medical care. Kate's trauma has made Justin think of abortion as much more than a women's issue. It impacts the fathers just like it does the mothers, he says. Don't just shut your mind to it and think, this doesn't involve me. If you wait until it impacts you, well, it's too late. A few weeks after her abortion, Kate was chasing her kids and her nephew around the house when she missed a call from Joseph Biden. She thought it was a prank call or even a nasty heckler. But after a few text messages, she realized that the president and the first lady were, in fact, trying to reach her. I actually had my son on my hip, and he had peed through the diaper all down my side, she says, laughing for the first time since our conversation began. I certainly never thought I would get an opportunity to speak to the president. If I did, I didn't think it would be with pee down my side. That's how it goes for moms sometimes. The president and the first lady shared really kind words about what we went through as a family, she recalls, and invited her to sit in the first lady's box at the president's State of the Union on March 7th. Cox says the family doesn't have concrete plans to do more explicit advocacy around abortion, but she does plan to continue sharing our story when we can. She says she's grateful for the Biden administration's work on reproductive rights and supports the work Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are doing around abortion access. I don't particularly enjoy being involved in politics, Cox says. Right now, she doesn't have any plans to appear in any Biden ads ahead of the 2024 election, but she adds, never say never. And whether or not they choose to be in the public eye, both Coxes say they now plan to become regular voters, a political evolution that reflects the way in which abortion access has transformed from a question of feminist choice into a question of medical necessity. What I've learned from this experience is that if you are pregnant, if you love someone that is pregnant, if you become pregnant, well, you have to vote like your life depends on it, says Cox. Justin adds that abortion access is now his number one issue. Kate and Justin get up from the kitchen table and slip back into the familiar routine of busy parents with things to do. this trash that needs to be taken out, a dog that needs to be walked, two sippy cups that need to be washed. Their kids will be home soon. Our next story is entitled Dirty Chai or Dirty Labor Practices. This is by Kimberly Turtell from the Fordham Political Review. Unions had their fair share of publicity across the country in 2023, from the United Auto Workers striking in Detroit to the Writers Guild and SAG-AFTRA strikes in Hollywood. And the momentum of such movements won't just stall because a new calendar year had begun. In the past, Starbucks has received attention for its alleged anti-union tactics, and there appears to be a rising tension between the company and its employees. In December 2023, the National Labor Relations Board announced that they would attempt to force Starbucks to reopen 23 of its stores after they were closed to prevent employees from unionizing. Of the 23 closed stores, 8 were already unionized, and the remainder discussed the prospect of unionization. The board found that Starbucks closed the 23 stores without prior notice to Starbucks Workers United, the union behind the campaign, and without affording the union an opportunity to bargain about these decisions. An administrative judge will hear this illegal act of union busting, but the date for the case is yet to be determined. Starbucks has not commented on the subject. But closing these stores was not the first time Starbucks has engaged in this behavior against Starbucks Workers United. Starbucks started the process of suing the union in October of 2023 for a post that supported Palestine. The post stated, "Solidarity with Palestine." It was online for only 40 minutes before it was removed from the social media site X because union leaders did not approve it. Still, the company claims that this post upset the Starbucks customers and harmed the company's reputation. Starbucks' suit against the Starbucks Workers United also accuses trademark infringement, taking issue with the union having Starbucks in their name and using a green and white logo resembling the trademarked Starbucks logo. To this claim, the union contends that it is common practice for unions to utilize their company's name and logos in their messaging, citing the Amazon Labor Union and the National Football League Players Association. As a company, Starbucks has spoken about the increasing unionization of their employees. The company's founder, Howard Schultz, recently stepped down as CEO in 2023. However, before he gave up that position, he interviewed with CNN. The main topic of the conversation was Starbucks Workers United. Schultz, who had already stepped down twice before, said that he came back as CEO of Starbucks because the company was not leading in a way that was consistent with the history in terms of being a value-based company, the same issue Schultz believes caused the unionization efforts among the stores. However, in the interview, Schultz did not acknowledge the unionization efforts have only increased across the country during his final term as CEO, failing to recognize that the values he sought to reinstate with his return were not as important in satisfying employee demands as initially thought. Moreover, the company leader was adamant that they would only participate in bargaining sessions that are in person due to possible foul play that may arise in a virtual setting. However, many union leaders have pointed out the hypocrisy of this requirement, as Starbucks administration regularly uses Zoom meetings for their own purposes. To those trying to unionize, this is just another union-busting tactic the multinational corporation is utilizing. Starbucks has a long, tumultuous relationship with the Starbucks Workers United, engaging in predatory practices that discourage the union from expanding its reach. So, what does this mean for the future? As pressure continues to amass within both Starbucks corporate administration and Starbucks Workers United, it can be expected that all eyes will be on the company to see if it chooses to proceed with or abandon its illegal labor relations and its union-busting tactics. And I think we have time for one more. Taylor Swift isn't the economic force, it's her fans. And this is from Time.com by Misty Heganis. The exact moment Taylor Swift came gliding into my life was when she released The Man music video. I remember it all too well. I was leading projects in a predominantly male organization. Colleagues had been quick to criticize my violations of unwritten rules regarding how women should lead. Rules dictating niceties, get-in-line supportiveness, and instruction with subtlety. The Man, written from an ambitious woman's perspective, tells the story of living in a world built for someone else. It's fun, lighthearted, and empowering. Swift has another song, Mad Woman, written from the perspective of how that patriarchy perceives these ambitious women. This song is dark, intense, and isolating. The fact that these two songs tell the story of each patriarchal opponent with such precision is what makes Swift a lyrical mastermind. Her lyrics made me feel seen. In fact, many of us can ourselves be seen in her music. It drives her fandom. She taps into our feelings by writing deeply about her own. But the universality of her lyrics is not the only factor driving Taylor Swift's megastardom. The weight of her fans' purchasing power is the other. The media repeatedly posits that Swift is a powerhouse uplifting economies across the globe. Yet she would be the first to acknowledge her fans as the true driving force. She understands their power because, in what can be best captured as a full circle movement, she also is them. Swift represents how far millennials have come in claiming ownership and independence over their financial lives. I call this phenomenon Swiftianomics. Let me explain. Reports argue that millennial suburban women are Swift's biggest fans, but attend an Eras Tour concert and you see men and women, young and old, parents and children, and people from cities in rural and suburban areas. Her success, while influenced by the accelerated economic independence of women, is not contained by it. Her lyrics transcend demographics, giving her a wide-ranging audience. More specifically, a fan base spanning over half, 53%, the U.S. adult population, more than 137 million fans. Swift's stardom has also accelerated because young adults, particularly women, have gained more economic agency in recent years. This is not only largely due to millennials living alone or away from their familial unit, but also in some cases living with parents while working. In the latter scenario, they accumulate earnings with more flexibility to spend on luxury goods by saving on the essential costs covered by their parents like food and rent. Additionally, household consumer expenditures have historically been decided by women, but usually with the approval of another adult, like a spouse. These expenditures, generally forced on purchasing goods and services for family rather than oneself. These days, more women than ever before are living alone, which builds economic independence and eliminates positions of unequal bargaining power within the household. Women today are almost twice as likely to live alone in their early 20s relative to their 1950 counterparts, and fewer live with a spouse or a child. And if they were to marry, which also quickly becomes less of a social obligation, women are bringing independently earned resources with them. The increased economic freedom experienced by women helps explain why they are purchasing goods and services driven by their own preferences in addition to household needs. They're willingly spending on items that give them joy, like variants of vinyl records or the Eras Tour tickets. Their shifting economic power directly contributes to the Taylor Swift craze and the local economic whirlwinds that follow her concerts around the globe. Swift's take from the Eras Tour alone has been estimated to reach $4.1 billion. She is without a doubt financially powerful, a millennial herself making more than her partner and with lots of economic agency. She takes ownership over her own music and business, which fuels her success. She's controlled 85% of the revenue from the Eras Tour tickets, previously unthinkable in the music industry. She uses that to build out a concert experience for her fans and reinvest in communities along the concert tour path. What's more, parents now listen with their children and purchase tickets to a concert as a family affair. Daughters watch football games with their dads instead of TikToking with friends as they look for Taylor Swift in the audience, and viewership soars. The world intergenerationally revolves around her because she speaks to many of us, and this gets to the point. The Taylor Swift effect is a mix of universality in her storytelling and downstream product of growth in women's economic power and agency, of which she is a primary example. However, she is but one example. We see it play out in other aspects of society like women's sports, female-focused wealth management, shifting support for care policies, and in all aspects of entertainment. That, in essence, is Swiftianomics at its best. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been reading from articles from Time.com and an article from the Fordham Political Review. I'm Steve Sacco. So long until next time.